Annalee, in this book, you are totally upfront about being a loner. But what does that exactly mean to you? I mean, what makes you a loner?
It's so simple to me, and yet for some people it's so impossible and intolerable to understand. It just means I get most of my energy when I am by myself. I feel natural, I feel revived, I feel peaceful by myself as compared to being with other people. Doesn't mean I'm a misanthrope. It doesn't mean I'm incapable of being around people. It doesn't mean I have social anxiety, kind of the opposite. It just means I get my energy from being alone. And people who are non-loners, they get their energy from being with others, and that's fine too.
Isn't that the definition of being an introvert versus an extrovert, or do you think there's a difference?
Pretty much, yeah. I just don't psychologize it the way that Jung did, because he's the person that invented those terms.
Okay. So it's funny, I know I talk on the radio for a living, but I'm actually like that too. Like, there are a lot of social settings I avoid. Big parties, any kind of crowd scene, outdoor concerts, professional conferences, those are kind of hard. I mean, pretty much any event where you have to stand around and make conversation with people that you don't know that well. And I always thought I was just, you know, shy or socially anxious or introverted. And your book made me think, I'm a loner.
Yeah, it's not such a bad thing. It's just a different thing. But what is weird is the amount of prejudice that still gets leveled against loners in our society. And that is a whole nother story. Why is that? But, you know, it's not okay to make judgments on people based on their ethnic heritage, their gender, their sexual orientation. And yet, so often I have found, and still find, as you might find, people leveling judgments based on people's preference for being alone, and to the point of accusations. Oh, he must be crazy. He must hate people. He must have social anxiety. Well, you know, maybe not. Maybe there's a positive thing about it. Maybe that person, he or she, just feels fine, feels good when they're alone, to the point where they're getting more stuff done. They're being more creative that way. They're being more authentic that way. They're being more mentally healthy that way. You know, that's one way to look at it.
Well, there are subtle ways, I think, that we get the message that wanting to be alone is not okay. I mean, for example, take the office party. Like, some people really enjoy those. They really actively look forward to them. But if you're someone who would probably rather staple your fingers together than go to the office party, then you either have to lie or you come up with some excuse for staying home, because it's never okay to say, no, thank you. I don't like parties. They're not fun for me.
Right. Subtle or non-subtle, to the point where office parties and family get-togethers, I get so many emails from readers who say, thank you for giving me things I can say to my family, because they do not understand why it's hard. I'll do it. Some people don't do it, but some will say, I do it, but it's hard. And now I'm able to understand why it's hard. You know, maybe I'm not like my siblings. Maybe I just feel more comfortable not chatting, not being chatted to for 2 hours straight. Maybe that drains me. In Party of One, I make a comparison where I say that for loners, extended social contact, for me, maybe more than an hour straight, is like giving blood. Giving blood is not a terrible thing. Sometimes we do it for a good cause, but it is literally draining and we need a rest.
So what do you say when family members get on you about, what do you mean you're not coming to the celebration for this or that?
In my personal case, usually I say nothing and I just go, because I don't want to explain it anymore and I don't want to get in arguments anymore. And to some extent, I think the individuals do understand. But again, being a loner pretty much means being in a minority. So you're going to be outnumbered. And if you can deal with it, just deal with it. And then afterwards, you've got your alone time. That's me. Maybe I'm not a confrontational type, right? So maybe I shouldn't have written that book. Other people are more confrontational. And I do get emails from readers who say, thank you for telling me what to tell them. Now I tell them that. And I spent Christmas with my dog and I was so happy. Me, I don't do that. But, you know, I kind of admire the folks who do.
Yeah, I've always felt a little bit ashamed of myself for not liking big gatherings. Because, you know, people go because it's supposed to be fun, right? You know, you go to the office party or the big outdoor concert or the football game. And, you know, if I do go to one of those things, there's always a point when I look around and everyone else seems to be having a really great time and I'm not. And I feel like I should be. I mean, don't you ever feel that way?
Yes, I have, and I spent my life feeling that way. The Girl Scout camp out at the, you know, even in school, at school dances, at slumber parties, everywhere, I would be the one who'd be like, get me the heck out of here. But no one else seemed to feel that way. And naturally, yeah, I turned it on myself. But part of the reason we do that is because society does it to us. This is, I think of it as one of the last big prejudices, you know, the anti-lonerism, because, yes, we're in the minority. We're one of other minorities, but we are the last minority that, again, it's okay to think harshly of, to sort of casually diagnose as mentally ill just because we are this way. So naturally, we're going to pick this up from the majority and from everything around us, and we're going to think, yeah, I must be some kind of freako.
Yeah.
What's wrong with me that I'm, yeah, I like this music, but I sure don't want to be with these 4,000 people, you know, in this stadium. Please let me just go home and turn on the radio. It's just, you know, we blame ourselves because that's what we see around us and that's what society does.
Have you been a loner as far back as you can remember? I mean, what were you like as a kid?
As far back as I can remember, yes. And I was an only child, so I was alone a lot. So it wasn't a conflict. My parents were both fairly lonerish, especially my dad. And so I didn't get criticized by them. My mom would occasionally, she was more socially conscious and didn't want me to be the freak. So she would enroll me in things that later just were torture. I hated them. You know, she
like
signed
what?
Me up for Campfire Girls. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I understand now why it was important to her as a parent and why it was important to me as a kid. And I did like the outdoor experiences and I liked learning how to do crafts and sing songs, but I did not like the social thing. It's still like, I'm just getting the shivers thinking about those meetings. And she enrolled me in a group guitar class, which again, I'm glad I learned to play an instrument. And I'm glad I learned how to function, because one of the things about being a loner, somebody asked me recently, you know, an extreme loner, I mean, maybe they're living their dream, but they're pretty dysfunctional and they're kind of a hermit. And that is true. We live in a crowded world, a very crowded world, in a crowded society. And there are so many prejudices against us that if we want to function, if we want to succeed, we need to learn their way. We need to, like, join the crowd sometimes, much as we don't like it. So I am glad that I was given these experiences as a kid, hate them though I did at the time. But I learned to function in society. I can be a professional journalist and interview people without freaking out.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like learning to have decent manners, right? I mean, that's part of socialization, is learning to have some social skills. But it's hard to tell where learning social skills and shaming, where those two things diverge. I mean, you know, as a parent, I can't tell you how many teacher conferences I went to where I was told my kids should really speak up more in class and participate more. And partly I was worried for my kids, but I also wondered why. I mean, why should my kid get a lower grade because he wants to sit at the back of the class and not talk?
Exactly. That just breaks my heart. And I know that's probably been replicated so many millions of times because, again, it's the prejudice. What is this assumption that student A wants to raise their hand and ask questions and talk and have pals in the front of the class, and student B, just as smart, just as cool of a kid, just as great of a future or whatever, just as good of a heart, wants to sit in the back as I did, as my husband did, the fellow loner that I married to? You know, we were in the back of the class. We're decent human beings. You're kids. But automatically, the prejudice, the billions of people that have gone to therapists and maybe not so great therapists have pathologized them as, you need help. I need to fix you. You need to be fixed, either with medicine or with something else. But there is something wrong with the fact that you don't like to raise your hand and speak up.
Well, we've pathologized so many things. You know, especially in the last 20 years or so, we used to just call it being shy. Now, of course, it's a DSM disorder, right?
Right. But see, being shy itself isn't always accurate. That person might be perfectly capable of talking to others. They just don't want to. It's more of a will. You know, shy is more of a can't help it, I'm nervous. I want to reach out. I want to talk to that person at the party. I just can't bring myself to. You know, shy is like a less, you know, psychological, scientific pathology way of saying social anxiety. But in my opinion, being a loner is not really the same as being shy. It's like, I could do it. I don't really want to. I will if I quote unquote have to, because I'm in your environment I'm a stranger in your land, I'll do it to be polite and to not look like a freak, because it's not worth it to me to look like a freak at all times. But I'm not shy. I just don't want to talk to you.
Well, going back to where we begin to sort of build the idea that being a loner is a bad thing, I really like your point that we use isolation as a punishment, right? So timeouts for kids, being sent to your room, starts there and then, you know, moves to solitary confinement in jail. You know, it's sort of, I guess, reinforcing the idea that being alone is unpleasant.
Yes, and those of us who were lonerish kids and were sent to our rooms, ha-ha, who had the last laugh? But yeah, it's very interesting because, again, the majority rules, and if they say it's a punishment, we understand it's not a punishment for us. You know, I hope I never go to prison, but if I do, yeah, put me in solitary. I will sit there with a book or just by myself. I'll be fine. But it makes us understand how important it is for non-loners to not be alone. Let's pathologize them. But it's a huge, huge deal. I wrote that book before the vast ascent of social media and cell phones. Ironically, what has happened in the last decade or so is that people no longer ever, quote-unquote, have to look like they're alone. They are always hooked up with someone, or at least pretending to be hooked up with someone electronically. That is so important to non-loners. Oh, dear God, don't let me be alone. Don't let me look alone. It being alone terrifies them. It bores them. They don't understand it. Again, I'm not saying either way is better or worse, but it sure is different.
So do you think technology has made it easier or harder to be a loner? Because I would have said technology has helped. I mean, as a radio producer, for instance, I started, this will tell you how old I am, I started before there was email. And to book a guest, you had to call them. I hated cold calling people. I would have to steel myself to do it. So when email showed up, everything got so much easier. And I think a lot of people prefer email to phone calls, you know, not just loners. But I don't know, I'm curious. Do you think technology has made it easier or harder to be a loner?
Well, me and you both with the cold calling, and it at first, I thought, yay, technology, this is so great. I don't have to call people. I can just type out these letters and I can wait for them to type back. And I was, whoa, this is great. I can get information online. I don't have to do it in some kind of group setting. But then social media came along. What's it called? Social media. Never in my wildest dreams could I, the loner, have predicted that this would literally take over what we knew of as society, communication, education, knowledge, friendship. This bizarre phenomenon, bizarre to me, in which everything is about how many friends you have, who most of whom you don't even know, and being liked, what? And posting extremely personal things for a lot of strangers to see. Oh, look, here's a picture of me. Here's what I did. Here's my family. Here's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, but Annalie, that's optional. You don't have to join social media if you don't want to.
I don't have to join it, but think of the pressure, right? If you are not on social media, there is a lot of pressure, even in, let's say, almost any industry you might work in. There is so much pressure. And within families, I don't see you on Facebook. What are you doing? Well, I'll tell you. Yeah, but I want to see it on my phone every day. You know, there is so much pressure to be involved in social media that, yes, opting out of it is possible and very courageous. And I'm, yeah, you know, but you will be ridiculed if you stay away from it.
So do you think people feel threatened by loners?
Yes. And you get this sense when every time a serial killer is caught or identified, or a school shooter is caught or identified, how many, there's always a countdown. How many seconds before that, weird Seattle loner arrested, you know, he was a loner, says the neighbor. There is so much in people's minds, in our culture, association between doing crazy stuff and being a loner. People are scared of it because it's different. They wonder, what are you doing alone? What are you doing there? I don't understand it. What could you possibly, it must be something bad because I can't think of anything good to do when I'm alone. The rest of us, we loners are like, oh yeah, you know, I read, I make stuff, I think, I walk in nature, I just sit peacefully, I meditate. But non-loners are like, you must be doing something weird.
On the other hand, if we're so disapproving of loners, how come, I mean, think how many superheroes are loners. I mean, Spider-Man, Batman, Superman, they all live alone in their caves or secret hideouts.
They do, because there's something, this nostalgic, heroic, epic hero figure in American, particularly American culture, is the loner. The cowboy riding to the horizon on his horse, the mountain man, the pioneer, you know, the inventor. We have these heroes in the, most of them in the past, and some of these superheroes come from that era when America generally admired this kind of person. Maybe they weren't all that kind of person themselves, but they admired it. Oh, yeah, that person has courage. That hero image has diminished over the decades, over this last century, a lot.
Really?
We can still, in a nostalgic way, kind of like, oh, yeah, Superman, but we're not seeing it in modern times with modern heroes very much.
Hmm. So we were talking about how I avoid big gatherings when I can. But I get the sense that for you, it's not just that you're unhappy in a crowd. It's that you're happier, maybe happiest, when you're alone. Is that right?
Yeah. I like to look at it that way, and that's a positive way to look at it. Although some who have been with me would tell you, you know, in a crowd, I am just like, get me out. This is torture. It's so fake. All this small talk. I can't, you know, I'll make eye contact, but it's not real. For some people, being in a crowd is the most real. I know someone who went to the premiere of a recent film with 90 friends.
Whoa.
90. They all went together to the cinema and, you know, yay. And to them, that was so real. But to me, oh, I think of a movie theater and a movie, I think of that as a completely private experience. Why would I want anyone I knew to be near me at all? I'd have to be distracted and, like, think about them. It's like me and the movie. So are you saying,
would you rather see a movie alone than with a friend or even with your husband?
Yep. For some years back, I joined a public radio station, and the benefit that I got, the little promo, was a year's pass at a movie theater, an art theater. And I was like, yay. I went to that theater almost every night by myself with some food. I just sat there. It was a time of my life.
Well, so I'm curious. You said you're married. How does that go over with your husband?
The secret is to marry a fellow loner, because they completely understand. Often, one time we had another similar deal. We both had movie passes to a different theater, and we both went alone. And sometimes we sat together, and sometimes we didn't.
You're kidding?
You go about
to the
movie afterwards. Yeah,
but and sit in different places.
Yes, because I didn't like to sit in front. I like to sit in the back. You know, loners can find other loners. Often I've been kind of ridiculed. It's like, oh, you're a fake. You're a hypocrite. You're married. Oh, you're married? Oh, well, you don't even count. Like I say, you know, lonerism is a kind of spectrum. And yes, your extreme, super 100% loner is a hermit. They don't want to be even with a romantic partner or one friend. But most of us, we can relate to a few core great friends that we love and a partner, sure, our kids maybe, hopefully. But, you know, I was lucky to find at a fairly young age someone who was very much like me in the I cannot make small talk, I do not like crowded situations. It's down to that. In a way, it's like black and white. Crowded supermarket, I am going to hate it. Other people are going to love it. That's all I need to know.
Mm. But it's interesting how we tend to think of being in a relationship and being alone as mutually exclusive, right? We put these are totally different categories. So I'm curious about what you think being alone has taught you about how to be in relationship.
Right. Well, being alone, often it's a physical thing. I am in a room alone and no one is there, but often it's more metaphysical. It's having your quote-unquote space. Maybe that person, another person or two, is in the same physical square room with you, but all of you, each of you, might be alone. You might be alone in your thoughts, alone in your activity. You're not expecting anything of the others to give you something or do something for you or with you, and they're not expecting it of you. And that is a kind of respect that loners can give each other. So in a relationship, long-term relationship, that that is what I am so grateful for, is this understanding that we have, that we need our private time. Doesn't mean I hate you, I don't like you, I don't want to be with you, you're boring to me. It means I love you, and you understand that I am going to feel much more sane if I go for walking by myself for an hour, and you do some similar thing. Understood between us. That, to me, is a big part of love.
Do you ever feel lonely? I mean, I'm asking because, so in my 20s, I went to London for a week by myself, just for a vacation. And I had never really traveled alone before, and I love London, and I just wanted to go there by myself. It turned out to be a lot harder than I expected. I mean, a lot of the time, I felt invisible and lonely. I remember crying at night in my lonely little, you know, room in the B&B. It made me wonder, is there an art or a skill to being alone and learning to enjoy it?
Well, you know, probably for you in that experience, part of the pressure was traveling is hard. I used to be a travel writer, and, you know, there's just a lot of extra stresses that come with traveling that would really just pressure you. And also being in a foreign environment, even if you love London, it's not your own personal culture. So you're having to work hard at doing the etiquette there and you know, understanding the rules there. And being a woman in your 20s is also hard. And there's mm-hmm. prejudice in society against women being alone in their 20s. What are you doing? That's weird, you know. You know, so there's just all these extras in that particular situation. I can imagine it. I have traveled alone. I didn't mind it. I liked it, but it was within the USA on a Greyhound bus. So it wasn't quite so stressful. Generally in my life now, no, I do not feel loneliness. And I could, maybe it sounds radical, but I cannot remember a time when I was lonely. Maybe I missed a person who had passed away or had moved away or was not with me that I really loved, but lonely, that feeling I've heard so much about and so many songs are written about and that I hear about, I do not know that feeling.
Wow. I think I'm envious. We've been talking about how it's hard to be a loner in our culture. Are there cultures where it's even harder?
Yes. And in Party of One, for Party of One, I looked into that. I talked to people from different cultures and, you know, what was it like for you as a loner or as a non-loner in that culture? And yeah, I cannot speak for other cultures that I haven't lived in. But what I was told by people from those cultures was that in Chinese culture in particular, it's very, very social. It's very, very family oriented traditionally and still group oriented, you know, what's communism? Communism is the commune. So that's very, very social and group. So it is very hard for someone to be a loner-ish type of person in that environment. What are you doing? Where are you going? You know, and why? We don't like that. A lot of prejudice. And, you know, Latin America, a lot of the sort of group activity, you know, the whole carnival stereotype is true. And, you know, again, family oriented, where are you going? What are you doing and why? So, those were the two that stand out to me. Of course, you've got Scandinavia, where the joke in Scandinavia is what's a classic Scandinavia? I saw this online the other day. What's a classic picture of Finland? And there's this photograph of a bus stop and everyone's standing 3 feet apart and all facing in the same direction so they don't make eye contact. And I thought, I'm going there. If it wasn't for the cold, I'd be there.
So in our culture, I mean, there are times of year when it's harder to be alone or to be a loner. I mean, any holiday. For instance,
yeah,
I was thinking about Thanksgiving, right? Like there's this idea that if you know somebody who's going to be alone at Thanksgiving, you should take pity on them and invite them over. Even if, you know, if you're a loner, maybe you would prefer to have Thanksgiving alone than with some stranger's family. But still, we're supposed to take pity on them. Or Valentine's Day, that's a hard one to be alone on, especially if you're not, you know, in a relationship.
True. And this compulsion to invite the person over when you fear they're going to be alone is just indicative of the whole bigger prejudice, not in the sense of prejudice like I'm mean and I'm going to judge you harshly so much, but it is because I'm making an assumption about you. You know, as a non-loner, I'm assuming that if you are not going to be with persons X, Y, and Z, there is something wrong with you. You can't do it, or you're sad or nobody likes you. You know, there's got to be something wrong with you or your situation if you're alone at Thanksgiving or Christmas. These are group holidays. Why? Who says? A holiday is a more or less sacred event. It's a transition day. It's a day when we remember some special thing. And maybe your extroverts, your non-loners, like to do that in company. That's traditional. That's what organized religion is about. That's fine for them. But some people can feel the meaning of a holiday, whether it's whatever, Christmas, even Valentine's Day, they can feel it when they're on their own. They can think more clearly and, okay, I get it. The longest night of the year. This is what's happening right now. I feel it. But I wouldn't feel it if I was distracted by 10 people, even if I liked them. But they're distracting me with their talking and they're making me listen to their stories and the customs that I have to live up to and the, you know? I'd rather just, me, on holidays, I don't usually do this, but I would prefer just to spend that day walking alone on the beach, in the woods, somewhere alone. I would.
So I'm curious, you're, you know, clearly on a mission to try to reclaim being alone or being alone and have it seem like a less disreputable kind of condition. You know, I think one way to do that is to begin to build more positive stereotypes about people who are alone, and partly by, you know, thinking back to who are some great role models. So do you have in your head a kind of loner's collection of all-stars?
I do, but I'm going to interrupt myself to say that the opposite is when you said before, you know, are people afraid? Are people threatened by loners? The opposite of that is also true. People in their minds associate the loner with a whole, you know, rogues gallery of evil people. In Party of One, I create this concept that I call the pseudo-loner. And that is a person who everyone thinks is a loner because they spend a lot of time alone, this evil person. But if you research that person's life, the reason that they're spending time alone is because they've been rejected or they are somewhat freakish and people really don't want to be with them, but it's not their choice and they don't like it. For example, Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. In high school, was bullied and became an outcast. Never got over that. And had an abandonment issue with his childhood when he was left in a hospital. Took it personally. So, you know, he was a person that was what I call a pseudo-loner. He was alone a lot, but he did not want to be. And such people often become extremely angry at being, quote-unquote, forced to be alone, with being an outcast. Extremely angry and want to punish people around them. That is where your, you know, often your solitary serial killers and school shooters come from.
But that's interesting. You're making the distinction between some people are, you know, born loners. That's your temperament. And others are made, you know, perhaps through
some... I don't even
some...
think they are loners ever. I think they just are mistaken for loners because, yeah, they live alone. And, yeah, they don't have any friends, but not by choice. A loner, I believe, born or not born, is a loner by choice. But as far as the heroes, you know, I think of people like Mahatma Gandhi and Albert Einstein and geniuses and, you know, John Lennon and, you know, Emily Dickinson. I think of creative people, but readers have emailed me also, email saying, you know, you always think of the artist because, you know, not everyone can be an artist. I'm a loner and I'm not an artist. Are you saying I'm an inferior loner? Well, no, but as a kind of artist myself, I write and I draw, so that's who I identify with. But, you know, in the other realms, they say Bill Gates is a loner. And after she died, they said Rosa Parks was a loner. So in all fields, you can find your loner heroes, people who did great visible public things in the world that people admire them for, but in their private lives, like to be very private and have very private lives.
Did writing the Loner's Manifesto change anything for you? I mean, in terms of like your relationships with other people or with yourself?
It clarified things for me. It made me able to find words for what I was experiencing and to feel less, as you put it, less ashamed in a public setting. I don't hate myself so much for, you know, not wanting to be at this event or that event or in this setting. It's like, okay, I will just get through this. This is not my fault. And I'd always believed that it was my fault. I didn't become the great virtuous banner carrier because I am somewhat of a wimpy coward in real life, so that I haven't had a lot of confrontations. I haven't stood there on my, you know, pedestal saying, you know, I'm a loner, so I'm not going to do this. Like, I haven't. I'm
don't
just
even
as much
send
of a
me that invitation.
Yeah. You know, I haven't changed as far as anyone could see, probably just inside a little bit.
I'm curious, when you came out with the Loner's Manifesto, did you get hate mail?
Interesting. I didn't. In a way, it was almost as if the only people who saw it, like it had a special like loner detector ray, and the only people that found it were people who needed it. And I did get hear from people who weren't loners themselves, but found it because they had a loner child or partner. Mm. So they were also happy to find it. But it's weird. I don't respond very well to hostility. But I didn't get any hostility.
That's good. Hey, Annalie, thank you so much for coming in. And especially having heard what a loner you are, it probably wasn't all that much fun to come in and, you know.
Public transit, whatever. Yeah. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. So nice to talk to you.
Thanks for braving it. All right. Take care.
Of course.